earth, with that man, woman, sister, brother, mother, daughter, father, child, right next to us. And I didn't expect that, but that's my solsticial thought. And thank you for spending this great time with me and Steve Cates and all of you great callers tonight on Earthwatch on WBAI, Pacific Radio Network. And we want more wisdom from you at rknight, R-K-N-I-G-H-T, at WBAI.org. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight, seemingly located here in New York City. So thank you, everybody. You've been brilliant. And we close the program tonight with one of my original inspirations for this program, Earthwatch.
Matt is the captain of Alpha Centauri. We must be out of our minds. Though we are shipmates and bound for tomorrow, everyone here's flying blind. But we must believe in magic. We must believe in the guiding hand. 'Cause if you believe in magic, you have the universe at your command. Matt is the crew bound for Alpha Centauri. Dreamers and poets and clowns. But Bold is the ship bound for Alpha Centauri, and nothing can turn it around. But we must believe in magic. We must believe in the guiding hand. 'Cause if you believe in magic, you have the universe at your command.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program about science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Oh, you're following me on Twitter, are you? You saw in Facebook or Google Plus that we're going to do The Star by Arthur C. Clarke. We lie. We lie. We're doing better than that. We have a guest, Jim Files. So stay tuned. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. But you knew that because of the way that my theme just digitally did a number. Because I had the temerity to plug in a USB device and the machine just went... Never mind. Let's see. Announcements. Well... tonight you missed a really great reading, but we're bringing part of that to you, in the way of one of the two readers, Gemma Files. But that was at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Reading Series, which is one that I record, but not the one that I produce. So let me talk about the one that I produce in 2 weeks, January 3rd, next year. At the New York Review of Science Fiction Reading Series, we are going to celebrate a new anthology edited by Bart Lieb, who is a publisher and editor of Crossed Genres Press, which is an independent small press. And this is, I think, his first original anthology, and it's called appropriately enough for WBAI, Subversion. And that sort of says what the theme of it is. So we're going to have three readers from that anthology. One is Daniel Jose Older, who I actually met when Delia Sherman was on this program a couple of years ago. Not to be confused. She also brought me Carlos Hernandez, you know, so I'm thinking, wait, was that Delia? But no, I'm wrong. It was Cherie Renee Thomas, the editor of Dark Matter, who brought Daniel Jose Older to my attention. That's what it was. But by now, he would have come to my attention anyway, because he's published about five or six really great short stories. Okay, so he'll be one of them. And this will actually be his second time reading for NYRSF. The other person is K.T. Holt. I say it carefully like that because it's not Katie. Her middle initial is T, and she uses that as a writer. And the third reader will be Barbara Krasnoff. And Barbara read last April along with Lev Grossman, and she actually read the short story that is in this book, Subversion, a short story called The Red Dybbuk. Red as in commie. And the it's a wonderful short story, in my humble opinion. But she's not going to repeat that because she's already done it for that audience. And so she's going to read something not from the anthology. And Bart Lieb will host. So it's sort of a launch party kind of a thing. It's closer to a Datlow kind of a reading than a Freud kind of, a reading is one person forever. You know, it just goes on and on. Datlow has a writer's, how to put this politely, gangbang. She'll have, you know, seven people from one anthology in an hour. She does this at cons all the time, and it's, I mean, on the one hand, it's great, especially because it's like, here's Neil Gaiman, here's Ellen Kushner, here's Bang Bang, you know, just all these great, great people that she gets together. But me, I like the whole story. I like more than fragments, something with denouement. But, you know, we're both right, is how it goes. Just, you know. And we, since we each do the two, no, I shouldn't say the two, because Eric Rosenfield has a reading series also in New York. Well, it's Brooklyn, but hey, I'm from Brooklyn. But we do the two Manhattan readings. And, well, this will be mine. And next month she has the Kellys. James Patrick Kelly and Kelly Link. So there's a link between the Kellys. Anyway, Kelly Link has not done a reading in New York for a long time. The last one, in fact, was for us, was for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And this, she was, I don't know, 6-7 months pregnant with what turned out to be, sadly, a problem pregnancy. And she had the flu. You know, so, but she was a trooper. Came down from Northampton and all that. Well, she'll be reading in January for Datlow. We are the first Tuesday of the month. She is the third Wednesday of the month, which is really difficult for me because my show is now on Wednesdays. So I went to a reading tonight where Kathy Sedia, I'm not going to say her first name properly, Ekaterina, is it?
Ekaterina,
thank you, was one of the two readers. And Gemma Files, who I have read actually more of her nonfiction than her fiction, but I met in at ReaderCon earlier this year when we were thrown onto a panel together where basically you had all these people that write often shocking things in their literature, and I'm the squeamish one, which she who ran the panels and everything knows darned well that this is my reaction. This is Rose Fox. And so, and I've often cited that one of the stories that turned my stomach happily the most, which of course causes great glee to the writer, because that was his intent, was Charles Platt. I, not knowing that Charles Platt was Rose Fox's father. And also, Gemma Files was on that same panel. And Gemma, do you have any recollection who else? There was at least one other person on that panel.
Yes. Yeah, there was. But unfortunately, no. It's gone completely out of my head.
Yeah. Same here. I mean, I couldn't even remember when we were meeting tonight just what panel it was. I just knew what convention it was. And I know that because I don't go to many conventions anymore. So it was easy for me to spot which it was.
Yeah.
With us also is her husband, Stephen. I'm sorry, you're going to have to do your... I didn't study you.
Well, some people pronounce it Zeke, but mostly it's Steve Barringer.
Zeke? Is that a scarecrow kind of reference? Is that?
I prefer to think of it as my nom de guerre, but...
very good. Okay. But you know why I say scarecrow?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, my God. People here... I mean, Gemma off the air knew what Hour of the Wolf meant, and was familiar with Varg Demon, the movie, which is Hour of the Wolf, although it's actually an ancient concept. And few people would know Zeke. Gregory Maguire, who I had on the program about a month ago for Out of Oz, just being published, didn't know that.
Ah.
Shame. Shame. You know,
But for those listeners who, unlike myself, of course, might not have recognized the reference and might not have just bluffed their way through that whole thing, what exactly is the Zeke reference?
It's the name of the farmhand.
Ah, yeah. Of course, I knew that all along.
It's the name of the farmhand in what town is it in Kansas?
Man, that I don't know.
Well, that Gregory would know.
That I don't know either.
Yeah. Well, someplace in someplace in Kansas, which then becomes not Kansas anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's the farmhand that turns into the scarecrow.
Ah.
So if you do a stage production, which of course Gregory Maguire's book Wicked got turned into a stage production, Zeke and Scarecrow are one and the same.
Yeah.
So that's what it comes down to. Oh, fire scarecrow.
You know? Yes, of course.
Yeah, that's Zeke.
Okay.
Perfect.
Yeah. So I have a friend who, in fact, was in some production of Wizard of Oz.
Of Zardoz.
Yeah.
The Wizard of Zardoz. Now, that would be a show that would be interesting to
see.
Oh, my God. John Borman.
For the costume design alone, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you are a film critic, Gemma, among many other things.
I was a film critic, yeah. I was a film critic for... Well, I mean, I still...
Because that's how I primarily knew your work.
Yeah, I still talk about film on my blog, but nobody's paying me to do it. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Yeah. But you were.
Yeah, I was a film critic for 8, almost 9 years in Toronto. I worked for a small weekly newspaper called iWeekly. And
EYE. It's not a Macintosh weekly.
It's EYE weekly, which actually doesn't exist anymore. It went essentially out of business earlier this year. Mm. And
Not even publishing on the web or anything.
No, it's just gone. Their backlog of archived material is still there, but the thing itself is gone. However, at the time, I was sort of like, I don't know how I feel about that. And then I realized, wait a minute, there's this other weekly that just opened up called The Grid, which employs basically the same people. So, I see what you did there,
uh-huh.
Which is that you went out of business so that you wouldn't have to deal with whatever.
Everybody watching their radios, look at the wiggling figures.
Yeah.
Fingers.
Yeah. It's
a good thing I didn't read this morning, isn't it?
That, you know, so that you didn't have to deal with whatever was attached to your name anymore, literally.
In marketing, I believe they call that a radical rebranding.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not New Coke. It's,
it's the Grid Coke.
Yeah.
Yes. But yeah, it was an interesting time in my life. It was something that I guess I'd been building to, and I'm glad that I did it. But by the end of it, I was extremely glad to not be doing it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Even though at the time I felt that I had been forced out of my position at iWeekly, which was actually true. I was told point blank that I was way too old at the age of what, 30?
About 33 at the time.
Yeah, over 30, okay.
Yeah. I was way too old at the age of 33.
You would run your Logan's Run of criticism.
To be writing for a hot, hip, young Meg like I.
Uh-huh.
Yes. So there you go.
I feel that way, and this show has its 40th anniversary next month.
Exactly.
So.
But, it was fun. It was fun while it lasted. And as a result of that, I was able to get a couple of screenwriting jobs. And as a result of those screenwriting jobs, I was able to start teaching screenwriting and film history.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for, again, almost 10 years until that timed out as well. the school that I was working for just went out of business. It happened between Christmas of one year and the summer after that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our parent company came to the Christmas party and we were like, so we've been doing this and we've been doing that and everything's going so well. And they were like, yeah, we're shutting you down.
Why do they always do this stuff at Christmas? They always do. You know, people get laid off. It's like, well, you know, we're not giving you bonuses here, but it doesn't matter because we're giving you 2 weeks' notice.
Yes. Mm. A severance package.
Yes, exactly.
That's what you're getting for Christmas.
If you're lucky, you're getting a severance package.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Been working here 51 weeks, so, oh, sorry, no severance.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, again, that was also interesting, and by the end of it, I was not happy to be fired just then, but happy to be out of it. It happened to coincide with my son being diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, which, again, was not the most pleasant thing in the world, but it was kind of good to be home so that I could be his intercessor and be primarily there to get him on the right track towards the therapy that he needed. And then about a year after that, I started working on my first novel. So,
yeah, I was going to ask about that because you've done tons of short stories for years and years and years.
Yes.
A lot of television scripts.
Well, not a lot. I've done 2 television scripts.
I thought it was more like 10. I'm sorry.
No, not 10. What happened was...
This is, by the way, what one gets for skimming through Wikipedia, which are 2 mistakes right there.
Mm. Well, what happened was 5 of my short stories were optioned by now defunct TV show called The Hunger.
Which was not that bad, was it?
Yeah, it wasn't terrible.
Both seasons are now available on DVD through Amazon, if anyone cares to look it up or to search for the product itself.
I think it's on Netflix.
Yes, that's right. You could stream it.
Yeah, yeah.
The episodes that I wrote are the episodes called The Diarist and Bottle of Smoke. They were both in the 2nd season. And other episodes include Fly By Night and the ever-popular Wrath of God, which is kind of a weird case. It was ostensibly adapted from my short story called The Guided Tour, which they only optioned because it could possibly be it had no actual sex in it. You have to understand this was erotic horror. So,
or at least as erotic as the television channels of the time would let you be.
Well, pretty erotic.
Canadian television channels.
Canadian, yeah.
True.
Yeah, which is why if you see a woman getting totally naked in an episode of The Hunger, she's Canadian.
Yes.
Yes.
And if it's here, it's cable.
Yeah.
And Canadian.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. So they had optioned The Guided Tour, I think, essentially because it didn't actually have any sex in it, but if you squinted, you might be able to manufacture some, and it would be heterosexual sex.
So this wasn't Torchwood?
No, it wasn't Torchwood. But funnily enough, the person who came in who was assigned that particular episode as a director had just come out of the closet. And the first thing he said was, well, you know, I really want to do a gay story, and so someone else had to completely rewrite that story.
Oh, good. Although what you read at KGB tonight was certainly...
I could name 4 stories off the top of my head that they could have optioned that
were perfectly happy sex.
Perfectly.
Gay sex, whatever.
I'm not saying they were perfectly happy gay sex, but at the same time, they were gay. And, you know, so they kind of... One hesitates to say screwed themselves, but
yes,
at any rate, the final episode is called Hidebound,
and that's happened in at least a couple of science fiction stories, hasn't it? People screwing themselves.
Yes, it has.
Yeah, the man who folded himself, David Gerald,
and
which I call the man who fondled himself,
and in at least one of my stories. The Narrow World.
Okay, very good.
Yes.
And now I'm trying to... There's yet another one. It's not Rick Bowes, although I'm sure he's thought of it. he was at your reading tonight, so... we'll get around to it.
Sometime. Okay.
Anyway. But you did a lot of short story writing, a lot of screenwriting, so it was it was actually well into your now ancient career.
Yes. That I finally started to write novels.
Yeah. And again, I hope everybody watching the radio saw the fingers wiggling when I said ancient career.
People had been telling me for about 10 years up to that point, you know, wow, you have to write a novel, right? Because that's where the money is, wiggle, wiggle.
Short stories, you can earn easily $10 a story if
to,
you know, Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wrist Letter.
Absolutely.
No, actually, no, Gavin and Kelly pay more than that. They pay about $30.
Yes. And
that's not bad.
No, it's not bad at all. Actually, the first short stories I ever sold, I sold for $5 American and copies. So,
and people, by the way, should not think that this means that you're selling to something that comes out on mimeograph.
Back then it was, actually.
Oh, okay. But today,
yes.
You know, I mean, Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet has been, you know, discussed and featured in Time magazine.
Yes, exactly.
But this, you know, and this is what that market will sometimes bear.
Absolutely. And there's a fair amount of sales to be made and moneyed sales, actual sales, to print-on-demand markets and also to even to e-zine markets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's stuff that I've sold that has just gone up on the web and I'd be paid for it, so
right.
Which is pleasant. But yeah, you know, people have been telling me you really need to trade up.
It's also difficult, we should point out, for short story writers to get a collection published without a novel to act as an anchor.
This is the other thing. Although, actually, I had two collections published before I became a novelist. But I think that was more me kind of blundering into it than anything else, literally blundering into a person who was able to do that for me.
Yeah, I mostly came across your short stories in various collections, anthologies, a number of them Best of the Year, unless I'm mistaken.
A couple of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm very happy about that. That's wonderful. And, you know, and having the collections was also really good because I could wave them at people and go, look, here's a whole bunch of my stuff.
No, that is excellent.
But again, it was always write a novel. And I would get about three chapters into something and stall. It's difficult. It's hard to trade up. It's hard to go from writing something that's 5,000 words long or 8,000 words long or even 15,000 words long to something that's 100,000 words long.
Yeah.
You talk yourself out of it all the time. And the thing that actually helped me was what at the time I thought of as a hobby and possibly even a shameful hobby, which was writing fan fiction. I started because I was hugely depressed about, say, the fact that, I don't know, my kid has ASD and I got fired and stuff like that. And I got fired after having been fired.
Oh, even better, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I had already messed around with fan fiction, obviously.
And we should tell the listeners what fanfic is.
Okay. Basically,
those who missed my show with Naomi Novik, who started with fanfic.
Yes, exactly. You know, a lot of people do these days. And there's reasons for that, and I'll go into that. The methodology, actually, is something that is very useful if you're trying to train yourself to write long form, to write a long form narrative. But fan fiction basically means that you take someone else's existing narrative and you write your own story set in that world.
Yeah.
The first thing that I did pursuant to that is I wrote an entire Oz the TV show novel, which took place between the end of season 3 and the beginning of season 4.
Okay, and here we're not discussing L. Frank Baum.
Yeah, no, we're definitely not.
This is the Tom Fontana show Oz, which was set in the fictional Oswald Maximum Penitentiary prison.
Right. Yes. It took me a second, and then oh, right, of course.
That was it.
Because off the air we were on the air we were discussing Gregory Maguire.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But
L. Frank Baum.
But no, it was Tom Fontana whose mind I was
I'm sorry, a little more electric chair, Scarecrow. now there's a crossover waiting to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the allusions to Baum's property in Oz were many and deliberate. For example, the warden's name of the prison was Tim McManus, i.e. Tin Man.
Okay.
The nominal viewpoint character representing a non-criminal sort who was sent there as an object lesson by a vindictive judge after killing somebody in a drunk driving accident was a character named Tobias Beecher, who was essentially the stand-in for the Cowardly Lion.
Yeah.
Only he doesn't find his courage as neatly as the Cowardly Lion in the film did.
It takes quite a bit. But certainly by the end of the first season, things have turned around. Yeah. It's become a genital-biting, you know, crapping on people's faces machine. But yeah, anyways.
All the good stuff.
Yeah, it was, and actually I'm wrong, it was between the end of season two and the beginning of season three.
That's very interesting because I would not have picked you. You know, I'm thinking, okay, this person writes fanfic. What do they do? Is it, you know, is it like X-Men Slash? Is it, you know...
Done that.
it's very popular.
It is.
I know.
It is extremely.
I've had Chris Claremont on the show any number of times and
right.
asked him about that and just watched him sort of like go blanking.
His face fall.
And he'd just say, why? Yeah, it's like, okay.
Because
moving on, Chris.
Because it's a flashpoint of emotion. Yeah,
exactly.
I don't know.
Exactly.
All my life I've been interested in strong homosocial emotions, shall we say, interactions between guys, not only on a personal level because I am a slasher from way back. You know, when I was in... Slash fiction is
like,
homoerotic fiction.
Yeah, it started, I think, with Kirk slash Spock.
Yes,
and that's
exactly.
where the phrase comes from.
Yeah, but in a lot of ways, I think it's thinking about any two guys in some narrative somewhere and thinking to yourself, is there something going on there? There could be something going on there.
And if not, I'm going to write it.
What if there was something going on there?
I'll chime in here and say that there's actually a body of critical thought, and to say that about fanfic there's a body of critical thought relating to it says how much of a cultural phenomenon it's become.
Huge. But it's huge.
Massive.
That says that Slash is actually taking implicit tensions between any two characters and actualizing them in some way in a story that the official property didn't do. So technically it can be any arrangement or orientation or anything like that. But the key is you are finding tensions that are implicit in the source material and bringing them to the surface.
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
So in for example, you could say if you were writing X-Files slash fiction that any story featuring Mulder and Scully in an intimate relationship was Slash if it was set before the seventh season because it took attention that hadn't been actualized on the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is, I think in some ways, gets to the heart of fanfic, which is it's an attempt to expand the universe by doing things that the original property can't or won't do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, they would never actualize Steed and Peel.
Yeah.
And Diana Rigg and Patrick McNee had opposite opinions as to whether or not there was any romance.
Or whether or not there should be any romance.
That's
because,
right.
Because, you know, some people would argue that because heterosexuality is the default, to have a man and a woman in a working relationship where they do not end up, in fact, doing the nasty with each other is more interesting and is more different than what we think of as the moonlighting trope.
Right.
You know, where because we work together, eventually, you know.
And it's certainly no denying that it's easier in some ways to sustain an unresolved relationship than to make a resolved one or a transformed one equally interesting as it was before.
Yeah, if you resolve it, then it's called a movie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, or it's closure, a closure that then means no next season.
Yep, that's absolutely true.
Joss Whedon has said that that's why he can't write happy relationships because he finds them boring.
So he just kills people off. You know, that's so untrue, Mr. Whedon, because he had such a great relationship relationship between Wash and Zoe.
Zoe, yeah.
Yeah, you see, I didn't even have to say it.
No, I totally agree.
It's this wonderful relationship, especially the way those two actors played it, with Gina Torres just going, excuse me, I need him now, kind of thing, which is just so wonderful. And then what does he do?
And the gender flippery and the, you know.
Oh, it was fabulous. Yeah, it was really great. And so he takes an entire spaceship and he runs it through Wash. I mean, that is just so gratuitous.
Yeah.
He's constantly gratuitous, gouging Xander's eyes.
Damn it.
Yeah.
Anyways, but.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
You struck a nerve.
No, it's all right. It's okay. You know, to return to the, to the original thing. I've noticed that. To return to the original thing, I will, however, say that although all those things are true as impetus for why I write generally, to continue a narrative, to spin off in a direction that the canon is not going to do it, blah, 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 I'm not going to even front. It turns me on. It always has. When I was 8 years old and watching Julius Caesar, I was thinking about Brutus and Cassius. You know,
A3, Mark, yes. Brutus, and Cassius.
You know, no, just Brutus and Cassius. I thought Mark Anthony was was a bit of a dog back then, but you know, I hadn't seen Rome yet.
What a lean and hungry look.
Exactly. So listen, you know, and when I was in my teens and even my early 20s and I was attempting to explain this to people and say, you know, well, I guess I have a fetish. This is part of my sexuality. This is the way that I am. And people would be like, what? You're like, what? You what? What are you talking about? This was before the net, right? You know, I'm 44 years old. And
before the web, not before the web. No. Sorry, I get that way.
You know. But you know what I'm saying. So to find myself where I am now, at the point where culturally it has become a trope in itself, a kind of joke, that, you know, well, that's what women like. Women like, you know, taking guys and sticking them together like Barbie dolls, you know. And in fact, that there's a bit of a political backlash against it. Gay guys quite rightly saying sometimes, you know, listen, I'm not your posable sex bot. How dare you?
But this is just what men have been doing. I mean, you know, red-blooded American men thinking of lesbian relationships and all that. You know, that's just considered cool.
Yeah, that's debatable as well. I mean, I like to think that the characters that I come up with are a little better than a penthouse spread of two chicks.
It should probably be pointed out that although I'm not a slasher myself, I think what most female slash authors write is generally more defensible than what most fans of lesbian porn wind up doing. Because first of all, of course, in almost every slash story, there is usually a great deal of character development involved.
Yeah.
Sometimes, not always, there is a, you know, a significant movement called PWP, which stands for Plot What Plot. But also, and more bluntly, the plain truth is most slash fic is written imaginary material. Most lesbian porn is live action material that can only be produced by exploiting actual actresses.
Mm-hmm.
So there is, I think, a genuine existential difference there that puts one on a higher level than the other.
Yeah.
Yeah, and perhaps on a more intimate level as well. You know, when people say, blah, blah, posable sex bot, I feel like a lot of slashers like saying, well, how do you think that you can regulate what goes on in my brain? How can you think that you can regulate that? You know, even if it wasn't tied to other parts of my anatomy,
well, see,
I get to think about
Canada.
Whatever I want.
Here in the United States, we try to regulate everybody's brain.
Oh, okay.
You see, so.
Well, there I was up in Canada writing Plot What Plot about various things. And so I spent probably, I mean, I had, like I said, I had been writing fan fiction before that, but I went into this period of about 2 years where that was pretty much all I was writing. I mean, yeah, here and there I'd write a short story and stuff like that. But essentially that was what I was doing. And at the time, I was disappointed in myself. And, you know, I was like, I'm a published writer. What is wrong with me? But something that occurred to me over that time period was that it was training me to write sectioned continuing narratives and to say to myself, okay, so I'm going to write a chapter essentially of like 5,000 words, 6,000 words, and I'm going to turn it around real fast. I'm going to put it up on the net and get some comments back on it and see what the reaction is, and then turn around the next part, do the same thing, check it, put it up, bang, 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 bang. And fairly quickly, you realize that you've actually written a lot, that you've written things that are 30,000 words long, that are, you know, that are 50,000 words long. And from that, you say to yourself, well, that 100,000 word narrative that's been teasing me for the last 10 years, it doesn't seem so impossible anymore. Find something that you can treat like that, that can be as rewarding to you on some level, and you will be able to achieve the necessary impetus to carry it through to the end. But
that becomes a slippery slope, because now that you can write novel-length things,
yes,
next comes the T word.
Yes, the trilogy. Yes. So what happened was, there I was, happily slaving away over 310 to Yuma porn. and it occurred to me,
specifically the 2007 version with Russell Crowe and Ben Foster.
Yes.
Not the James Mangold 1957 version.
No, James Mangold did do the 2007 version.
You're right, he did.
Yes, mm-hmm. But not the 1957 version. Okay, so...
James Mangold was, well...
Yeah, yes, he...
Not around.
No,
not,
he wasn't.
Not directing, anyway.
Definitely not. It suddenly occurred to me, strangely enough, because I actually had been watching Naomi Novik put her first Temeraire book together, mm-hmm, from a distance, and had seen it developed through its phases, which I'm sure she told you about.
Mm-hmm. I haven't had her on the air now in about 3 years.
Okay, you look at those.
Yeah, that's
even
what happens
simply looking at those books without knowing the background, it is very easy to go, well, that's like Patrick O'Brien, except with dragons.
Mm-hmm.
I like Patrick O'Brien. I like dragons. Wait a minute. Similarly, I looked at what I was doing and thought, you know, if I moved some stuff around, I could be writing a narrative which was not based on 310 to Yuma, which would be something completely different and would be very much to my mind in terms of the stuff that I normally write. Like, for example, I could put, I don't know, black magic in this, or Aztec gods, or black magic and Aztec gods. And also,
not
I could...
Not a stretch.
Yeah, you know. And I could make one of the characters, you know, a degraded preacher, and, you know, I could make the other one different from Ben Foster's Charlie Prince simply by making him aware of the fact that he's gay. From the very beginning, and thus, you know, Chess Pargeter and Reverend Asher Rook were born. And around the same time, my friend Sandra Castori, who with her husband, Brett Savory, had started a small press called Cheezine Publications.
Okay. And I have to say, by the way, I don't know these people, yeah, but I've had a number of people on the air say that they have books from Cheezine and all that. And I have to say, I haven't heard of a bad book coming out of Cheezine. I mean, I don't know.
They have great taste.
I know, and
I'm not just saying that because they publish me, but, you know, they have great taste.
I'm saying this from a totally blind point of view. I don't know these people.
Yeah.
I just know that I have met a lot of good writers who've gotten a lot of good things out of there, and it's like, Cheezy, I've never heard of them, but wow.
Yeah, their packaging is amazing. The effort that they devote to their writers and to their projects.
The obvious love for what they're doing.
Absolutely. And, you know, you could see that in Brett's earlier personal writing and in Sandra's poetry. And
their names again?
Sandra Kasturi, mm-hmm. and who's the author of The Animal Bridegroom, which got a wonderful prologue from introduction by Neil Gaiman, and Brett Savory, who previously had been the publisher of the Chiaroscuro webzine.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, in that position, discovered some amazing people, you know, ranging from like Nadia Bulkin to all sorts of other people.
He's also published a number of stories himself, including the novellas In and Down and The Distance Traveled.
Yeah, Distance Traveled is a novella, but In and Down is an actual novel. And, you know, they met, they fell in love, they got married, they were at my wedding.
Published.
I was at their wedding. And they decided that they would start this imprint together. And so around the time that I was first working on A Book of Tongues, what would become A Book of Tongues, Sandra was going around to all her friends and essentially going, "So I hear you're working on something, right? You're working on a novel, right? Can I see it?" You know, and I... And when she got to me, I was like, "Yeah, I'm sort of working on something. I don't know if you'd want it, though. It's got like, it's like all this gay sex and, you know, gunslingers and hexation and
considerably pulpier than a lot of the stuff she'd published at that
yes,
point.
Yes, exactly. You know, I was sort of like, I thought you wanted literature." But as it turned out, no. As it turned out, she was fine with my my blood-drunk gay porno horse opera. And
with black magic.
With black magic, yes. And they...
I should mention that at Gemma's KGB reading tonight, she read this whole section, which had pretty much what she just described, and then said, "Oh, by the way, there's also..." Oh, no, it was Datlo.
Yeah.
Who says, "Oh, and by the way, they're supernatural in the book as well."
Yeah, just in case everybody thought this was a nice little romance between two guys who met during the Civil War.
Which it was.
Yeah, which it kind of is, but it also involves, you know, cutting out your boyfriend's heart to save him from damnation and stuff like that.
But, spoiler alert, please.
Oh, well, yeah, you know. Anyways.
That old black magic.
Exactly. So... So, yeah, she wanted to see it. I gave her what I had at that point, which was an outline and six chapters. And they decided over the course of, I think, the next 2 weeks to pick it up. And so I had begun writing it January the 2nd of that year, and I finished it at the end of that October.
It's not bad.
Yeah, and we turned it around over the Christmas holidays, and then it was published.
Now I'm going to ask the question I've asked many writers about, and some of them, big names indeed, have lied. but I know that you won't.
No.
Did you at the time know that it was going to be a series, a trilogy, in fact?
I did not, no. At the time that I was writing it, I really thought that I was going to be able to get through the entire story in 100,000 words, and I was so wrong. I was so hopelessly, hopelessly wrong. In fact, I'd been working off the same outline for 3 years. So, in fact, I guess I'd been writing the same novel, except in three parts over 3 years.
An admirable stance. Professor Tolkien said the same of his own book.
Well, he never intended Lord of the Rings to be anything but one novel.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Written in five books, defining the word book differently, but it got split up into three volumes.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, so I guess this would be in... This would be in... Eight.
Yeah. When I used to broadcast, but
eight
I don't,
parts.
Yeah, my production of The Council of Elrond. Mm. At this time every year, but it runs more than 90 minutes, what the show currently is. Oh, Tony, did you hear some kind of a complaint in there? No, it's not Tony Bates I'm talking to, but Tony Ryan. But
No, not me.
certainly not on the air about
the
measly little time slot.
We
no.
still got time.
Yeah, well, using up what little time I've got.
Yeah.
In I would always refer to the Council of Elrond as being Chapter 2, Book 2, Volume 1 of the novel Lord of the Rings, yes. Which is accurate,
yeah.
Because that's the way Tolkien viewed it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, I won't lie. I always thought that I would be able to get through it in 100,000 words, and I was hideously, hideously deluded. I actually remember that it was later that year. I was talking to a friend of mine who has since been published by Cheezing. Dave Nickel, whose wonderful novel Utopia has E-U-topia, has been doing really well, and whose second novel, Rasputin's Bastards, is going to be coming out next year. He said, "So how are you doing?" I said, I think I'm doing pretty well. I think I'm about, you know, I mean, I'm about 80,000 words in. And he goes, how far do you think you are through the story? And I go, about a third. He goes, yeah, you should probably talk to somebody about that. And so I talked to Sandra, and she said, well, all right, you can probably have another book, but not three, because horror doesn't do trilogies. I was like, yeah, no, I totally understand. And then I got to about 80,000 words into the second book, A Rope of Thorns, and same thing happened. By then, she was actually fine with the idea of me doing a trilogy because, you know, one of the weird things that happened between the first book and the second book was that it got reclassified in the system. So that if you walked into any given Chapters or Indigo in Toronto, you would go to the horror section and find A Book of Tongues, and then to get A Rope of Thorns, the second book, you would have to go to the fantasy section. And fantasy runs on trilogies, as we know.
Yes.
So what I'm trying real hard to do now is to rebrand it, I guess, as dark fantasy.
So that you don't need a pedometer to get from volume one to volume two.
Exactly. I mean, when all three of them are out, they're going to put them in.
The third one will be science fiction or something. Yeah, exactly. All through the. Have you finished the third book?
Almost.
Okay, and does it have closure?
Yes. Yes.
Ooh. In so many ways.
Okay. In so many ways. Yes.
Oh dear. Oh dear. Spoilers.
There's all sorts of closure.
Yes. Well, the story ends. You know, yes. That's a spoiler.
Yes, exactly. Speaking of spoilers, let me just mention that this is WBAI, New York City. Listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. And this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and we are talking with Jimophiles. And Stephen, I'm sorry. I mean, I'm asleep.
Steve Berenger.
Thank you. I don't know why I'm doing that. I mean, it's, you know, I know the name Berenger well enough. There's actors and all kinds of good people with that name. But I'm just like... this is partly why I think I decided not to read this evening. Although... had Gemma not been here, I would have probably done just that.
Mm.
But there's an old WBAI tradition, for those who don't know, of doing The Star by Arthur C. Clarke, now that I don't have time for Council of Elrond. But this, too, will all, you know, it'll all get worked out. If I had pushed, I could have gotten a separate time. So anyway, but wanted you all to know. And I remember now that there was an announcement that I was that I should have made that isn't just readings, and indeed involves the word spoilers. And that is that, of course, Christmas Day, Doctor Who. That's all. You know, enough said.
Christmas Day. Doctor Who.
The lion, the wit. No, it's the orphan, the widow, and the wardrobe is actually the title of it. So, but I think the C.S. Lewis comparisons end at that point because there already have been spoilers.
So. Yes.
Yes. Nasty things, that. And the author of Doctor Who, the current author, Stephen Moffat, has a new movie out. I don't care that it's produced by Peter Jackson and directed by Spielberg. That doesn't matter. Stephen Moffat wrote Tintin, The Adventures of Tintin.
Right.
That's right, which is one of the reasons why I'm really hopeful for that movie. The fact that these other people are involved is fine and good, but they've all done turkeys at one time or another. Stephen Moffat, I guess this is his first film.
I'm not absolutely certain about that, but yeah, I'll take your word for it.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. But anyhow, that's, hopeful. I'm only starting to catch up on the year's films now. I saw Hugo yesterday.
Wow. Yeah, I haven't been able to see almost anything for, I guess, the last 2 months, two and a half months.
Yeah, and that's when they all started coming out. I must say, though, Hugo is one of those few movies, don't know about Tintin, but Hugo must be seen big screen 3D, and I think that's the first, you know, outside of Avatar. That's the first time I've said that.
I have a problem with 3D. It gives me a migraine, but I would be willing to risk it to see Hugo because I am a huge fan of Martin Scorsese.
Well, this is like, you know, massive. Nothing he's ever done. You know, I mean, yes, okay, this is a long tracking shot, and he's like, oh. but.
Yeah, and he's in it and stuff.
If you blink.
Yeah, well, same thing. Same thing with Gangs of New York.
But I'm a huge fan of Georges Méliès.
Yes.
You see. Yes. And I did not know before the movie opened. I was not familiar with the novel. The Adventures, is it, of Hugo Cabret?
The Invention of Hugo Cabret.
Mm-hmm. And that it was written by, is it the grandson of David O. Selznick? A grandson or grandnephew.
Yeah.
It's a Selznick at any
the
rate.
Wonderful Invention.
And it's a homage to silent film.
Yeah.
And of the two homages currently out about silent film, I say Hugo's probably the cooler one, in my humble opinion.
Well, cool. I am looking forward to being able to catch up with stuff after I'm finally done with this book.
Yeah.
Finally.
So the two books currently in print, just in print now, are, again, entitled?
A Book of Tongues is the first one. It's volume one in the Hexslinger series. And A Rope of Thorns is the second volume.
And the author is Gemma, G-E-M-M-A, Files, as in X.
Yes. Files, as in what you put documents in.
Yes, exactly. It just occurred to me, X, whatever. Gemma is an unusual name in the U.S.
Yeah. Yeah, not so unusual in Canada.
And almost common in England.
Yeah, absolutely, which is where I was born. I actually have triple citizenship because I was born in London. I have British citizenship and I guess EU citizenship now. Uh-huh. If I cared to grab a hold of that. The day that I was born, my father registered me with the Australian Embassy because he's Australian. And so I have Australian citizenship. And held an Australian passport for a long time.
So another meaning for Oz right there.
Exactly. And I have Canadian citizenship because my parents took me back there when I was about a little over one. Mm-hmm. And I've lived in Toronto, Ontario, my entire life. So, when I was born... In 1968, my parents were both actors, and they were looking for something that would go with Files, which is kind of a difficult last name. One of the people that they knew socially was a woman named Gemma Jones, who most people now know her as probably the mother in Sense and Sensibility.
Aha!
Yes.
Okay. She was good.
Yeah, she was amazing.
Yeah, she was a good Dashford. Yeah. Dashforth.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, Bennett's, Dashforth, they all...
Yeah, and also as the main character in a BBC miniseries called The Duchess of Duke Street.
Which I never saw. Yeah. I probably will.
Yeah, it's very worth your time. But also, I was interested to discover immediately after Ken Russell died that if you go to YouTube, you can watch the entirety of The Devils, which I hadn't seen since I was like 14. And I remembered it as being messed up, but wow, I did not remember.
YouTube has a number of feature films that are perfectly legal. And
exactly.
For a while, they had Varked him, and that was actually one of the first films that they were streaming the entire movie of.
I remembered it as being messed up, but wow, did I not remember how messed up it is.
The fact that Gemma saw the devils at the age of 14 is one of the many, many factors making her the wonderful person she is
today.
Yes,
exactly. But
well, any
the thing
Russell
that I hadn't
movie will scar you.
Yes,
you
exactly.
Know,
but
if
the
you
thing
watched it properly.
The thing that I hadn't known at the time was that the woman who plays Madeline DeBrew, who is the character that Oliver Reed's fallen priest, Urbain Grandier, ends up marrying. In fact, he marries himself to her as the priest at their wedding, is played by Gemma Jones, a young, sexy Gemma Jones. So if you want to see my namesake vibrantly nude with Oliver Reed and his massive mustachios, then hasten to YouTube and look up The Devils.
Yeah, and Oliver Reed, somehow he always just exuded good word, that kind of a thing. I mean, whether you're talking about, you know, Baron Munchausen or Oliver, he always had that thing.
Yes, animal magnetism, I believe they
really?
Call it.
Yeah,
There's a scene where all the nuns – in the nunnery that's run by Sir Jean des Anges, who's played, of course, by Vanessa Redgrave, at the height of febrile hysteria, are piled on a stepladder looking out this tiny little window, you know, for a hint of Father Grandier going by outside and going, oh, he's the most beautiful man in the world! And you're like, you know, I never thought of Oliver Reed that way, but
the Justin Bieber
see
of
it.
His day.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. He was quite something. He really, you know, he wasn't a great actor. That was he was a great presence, which is you know, something that you don't find that often anymore.
That's true. That type of
star
presence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, it's what I think made the Hollywood stars was not great acting. It was presence. Cary Grant was never a great actor. But, you know, you'd watch him in anything.
But, again, you know, if you get the right conflation of presence and vehicle, I think you can hit some pretty amazing heights.
To get snooty, the mise-en-scene.
Mm-hmm. And what Russell and Reed managed to do with The Devils is pretty spectacular. In terms of Reed's performance, I think it's actually one of the best performances he ever gave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And certainly one of the deepest ones and the darkest ones. So anyway, that's why I'm named Gemma, because of Gemma Jones.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's a lot of Gemmas who have come into my radar. There's Gemma Atherton, is it?
Arterton.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, yes. And she can act.
Oh, yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah.
She's a really, really good actress, and she is, of course, gorgeous. Drop-dead, ridiculous.
Well, good enough for, you know, Daniel Craig.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Bond girl kind of thing.
Well, yes.
Yeah, her finest hour,
but...
No, it's not. It's not, and yet, that's just saying, you know, the fact that they... and even then, it's, you know... It's not that bad. I happen to like that Bond film.
So do I. Absolutely. I actually saw it again fairly recently and was impressed by how unflinching it was.
Yeah.
You know.
And I'm the only person in the world to like Quantum Solace. I actually thought that was a worthy sequel. I've just...
Absolutely.
Not, you know, it's so obviously a T word. It's so obviously a trilogy in that third movie. Have they they finally greenlighted it?
Yeah,
I don't know if
they're
actually shooting it.
I'm fairly certain that they're either in pre-production or the initial stages of shooting. But
yeah,
it's hard to tell sometimes.
Yeah, MGM just sort of went to pot again. Mm. Happens to them all the time. They couldn't get funding. Get this, they couldn't get funding for a Bond film and something else. The trailer actually came out like the day before yesterday, called The Habit. The Hobbit.
The Hobbit.
That was it. They couldn't get
that little film, little tiny film.
Yeah, they couldn't convince people, oh, this will make money.
It's an entire generation of people who've grown up on those films now. That's the creepy part.
Yep, the Fellowship of the Ring came out 10 years ago.
I know.
Yeah, I know.
But that's a generation. 10 years is a generation.
Yeah. And let me tell people what I told people a generation ago about Lord of the Rings. Is I don't care how good it may be. I don't, you know, and perhaps Peter Jackson I would say that Peter Jackson made probably the best film that could have been made from the source material. You know, it's like, okay, I'll have to forgive no Tom Bombadil, but really no Sharky's End. I've got a problem with that. Mm. But all that aside, he made a pretty darn good series of films.
Yeah.
But before that, I knew what Frodo looked like. I knew what Gandalf looked like. I had, you know, Isengard in my head, and Rivendell, and all these places very, very specifically. And now that no longer exists. Gandalf must be Ian McKellen.
Hmm.
And Elijah Wood, God help me, must be
Frodo.
Yeah, Frodo, and all that. So let me tell people that before you go see The Hobbit, and I may make this a weekly announcement on this program, before you get Martin Freeman
stuck in your brain
as the young Bilbo stuck in your brain, and Ian Holm is reprising the old Bilbo in there, because it's all told in flashback, which makes sense.
Absolutely.
Although why Cate Blanchett is in there, other than the fact that, well, it's Cate Blanchett.
That's good enough for me.
Yeah, but Legolas, how does Legolas fit into The Hobbit?
I don't know. And,
well, spoilers. But anyway, neither here nor there. Let me just tell listeners, before you get Peter Jackson's images, as fine as they may be, burned into your brain, read the freaking book.
Yes.
That's all.
No, I agree.
Let your mind's eye do the special effects. Read it again. Enjoy it. Savor it. Because once that happens, it will be, if not supplanted, at least burned in. And it's not good to read the book with somebody else's imagery. Let it be a collaboration between Professor Tolkien and you.
Well, that's an interesting... I mean, you know, I don't disagree. I read The Hobbit when I was a kid. It was first read to me by my dad, and then I read it on my own, and I read it many, many times. And so, yes, I have my own specific ideas of what everybody looks like, and I have my own specific ideas. You know, even
better than Weta, better than Industrial Light and Magic. Yeah. There is Mind's Eye.
Yeah, absolutely. But that being said, I can say from my own work that there's always been a huge visual component in what I do. Mm-hmm. And long before I was a film critic and, you know, ruined myself for life by seeing, I don't know, like 5,000 friggin' films over a 9-year period or whatever. I've seen a ridiculous amount of movies. Ridiculous. I've seen so many movies that sometimes I have to Google myself to figure out if I saw something.
Wow.
By trying to find a review that I did of it.
I probably need to get you on the air at some point with Genevieve Valentine so I can just sit back and listen.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah.
You know, I love her. I love the way she writes about film.
Yeah, we can work this out.
Yeah.
Right, Genevieve? Oh, sorry, go on.
But one way or the other, you know, even before that, I was influenced by movies. I was influenced by TV. I was influenced by comics. You know, I would say that the influence of Vertigo comics on my work can't be downplayed any more than anything else can. And the idea of being able to completely separate, I see things like a film.
Mm-hmm.
I hear the components of the soundtrack in my head, and and there's a sort of unfolding of narrative that goes on like that. Prose is not film, obviously, and I know that because I've written screenplays. But in a lot of ways, I can't completely separate the two things in my mind. And, you know, so if somebody says to me, as people have said, well, who does so-and-so look like? I can tell you. You know? Mm-hmm. It's like, here's the germ of the person.
But any writer can, whether or not they're dealing with film, they know the imagery.
But the germ of the person is almost always... Is almost always
based on an actor.
Based on an existing actor, someone who I tripped across doing something, and whether that's like my remembrance of having seen something for 5 minutes, 10 years ago on TV at 3 o'clock in the morning, and going, I like that. Thing. I like that, I like that person. I like that moment. I like what I thought that story was going to be about. I might like it better if that person was a chick instead of a guy. What would that be like? Flippy, flip, 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 flip. But.
So I got to ask you, because you've now perhaps painted yourself into a corner, who's the preacher?
Oh, who's the preacher?
Yeah, yeah.
Clancy Brown.
I knew it! I knew it! And it's not just because of cowboys and aliens. It had to be Clancy Brown.
Well,
just,
he's a damn man mountain.
Yeah, he is. I mean, I won't see I won't see J.T. Petty's film with Clancy Brown in it because it's
the Burrows?
Yeah, because it's just going to be too horrific for me, and I'm squeamish.
It's amazing.
I'm squeamish, and I loved it. He's been on this show 3 times now.
Yeah.
Once as a writer and twice as a director, and 3 times as Sarah Langan's husband. But,
yeah.
And also as a Brooklynite, a fellow Brooklynite. But I'm a big Mr. Krabs fan. I mean, that's it. The Clancy Brown. And for those who don't know who Clancy Brown is, learn.
Yeah, seriously.
That's it. He's wonderful.
Carnival.
Absolutely.
Islander.
Carnival is probably the best evil preacher. And it's interesting that everybody's cast him as a preacher of... Well, he's not evil, obviously, in Cowboys and Aliens, but he has an
dubious morality.
Yeah, he has dubious morality and an interesting backstory, which we do not learn.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. But I remember Clancy from when he was young and hot. I mean, I remember him from Blue Steel, getting naked with,
Jamie Lee Curtis.
I probably just noticed her.
I remember him from when he was Rawhide in, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai across the Eighth Dimension.
That's right. That I remember. Yeah. That, but everybody's in Buckaroo Banzai.
Yeah, it's true.
Everybody in the world.
Everyone and the watermelon.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
What's the watermelon for?
I'll tell you later. And then he never does.
But both an underrated and overrated movie at the same time.
And an utterly formative movie.
Yes.
Utterly formative
absolutely.
For me.
Absolutely.
And
it
for a
really
lot of people
is.
In my generation.
Yeah. I actually went to a press screening of that where I actually have at home a little, little bandana, not bandana, something you tie around on the top of your head.
Yeah.
And it has in... Japanese, it says Bakaroo Banzai
on
it. I have that somewhere lying around. It's a fetish. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
What can I say?
Yeah, exactly.
And I worked here when I was telling you off the air how Barrett Searles is our drama literature director. I didn't mention that he was replaced here by John Lithgow.
Wow.
So
that's
it was
amazing.
John Lithgow's intern.
So, oh, man.
And I appeared on stage with him, my only stage appearance.
Yay.
And I'll just say that I played Piglet and he played Eeyore.
Nice.
I can see him being Eeyore.
He was a perfect. I didn't bounce him. I coughed. And I actually almost channeled him there for a second. Probably the world's only Lisko imitation.
And
let it stay that way.
Yes.
By the way, I think we should tell listeners, if you would like to call up and speak with Stephen Berenger and Gemma Files, the telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. Well, that was fast. People were ready.
Oh,
really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but I want to get more than one call in there. So,
okay.
Just so I can hang up on people.
Perfect.
That's actually a little truth to that.
Mm.
It's that you never know. It's like, oh, that one was too eager. Too eager. So it's like, okay, yeah. Okay, yeah, so Preacher's Clancy Brown. Who else is in your movie?
Ben Foster is Chess, definitely. Okay. Ben Foster, in his normal phase, is not redheaded and does not have green eyes. That would be the difference, I suppose. But, yeah, he's pretty much Chess.
Yeah, I love asking writers. Many of them do not have the mind's eye thing. I remember I challenged Susanna Clarke. Not long after Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell came out, who the casting was. And I thought at that time that Bob Hoskins was still young enough.
to be Gilbert Norrell?
Yes.
Hmm.
Ah.
Yeah, I think so. I think he would have been a very interesting...
See, I would have cast Norrell as older than that, but that's, again, differing visions.
Well, he is now.
Oh, yeah.
Bob Hoskins at almost any stage in his career, except maybe, you know, not his early career, but you know, by the time he had matured into an actor and got heard of in the United States to... present, just about, you know, as long as he stops playing Smee.
Wow. He hasn't done that for a while.
Yes, he has.
Seriously?
Neverland on Sci-Fi.
Oh, really? Are you kidding me?
No,
wow.
I kid you not.
Man.
No, they made him do that again.
Well, made him. I'm sure
they paid him to do that again. Okay, well, that's...
In the words of James Ellroy, you took the money, didn't you? Beep, beep, beep.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. Let's give this a whirl here. Good morning, WBAI. You're on the radio.
Happy solstice to you, Jim Freund, and to your guests as well. This is Bobson from Bulgaria.
How are you doing, Bobson? So this is second week in a row you've actually managed to listen from Bulgaria and call in. Wow.
It was the longest night of the year in the Northern Hemisphere, so why waste sleeping when I could listen to WBAI with you and Robert Knight before you had a great show as well, and I enjoyed that very much. And so,
he was doing very skiffy stuff, I noticed, yeah.
I'm having a bit too much fun to not be listening to the radio and be asleep, but it's...
See, Jim, we didn't put people to sleep.
Coming to 9:45 in the a.m. on a Thursday.
Yeah, I mean, it's morning where he is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you got to recognize it's mid-morning in Bulgaria.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that is the beauty of the internet and Skype, by the way, is that we can take international calls.
Mm-hmm.
Skype? What Skype?
Oh, what do you use?
I'm using a landline right now.
Oh, my God. Okay, Well, I mean, there's also, you can use a landline with, I use Google Voice, which does landline.
Yeah, I use that on occasion, too, but I don't have the device that is set up with it.
But that explains the fine vocal quality you have from halfway around the world.
Well, maybe a third. I'm only 7 time zones in the future from you.
There you go. There you go.
So, anyhow, I've enjoyed the show and your guests' participation very much. And I think I know you mentioned the story about a person making love to themselves. And I think I know the story you're talking of, but there's too much spoilers. I may write to you in an email. Did you get the email I sent to you last week, by the way?
I don't know that. Well, last week was a haze for me. Suffice it to say that I was cooking for 60 people.
Yeah, I heard about something about a great party you guys had. So
how do people know about this?
It's that famous.
It was on Facebook.
Yeah, but I didn't put it. No, people. Yeah, I had a party. Thank you. And then people go and they put it on Facebook and Twitter. And it's like, this is really indiscreet, people, because I can't invite everybody. And now the people that I didn't invite are, you know, looking at Facebook and going, he didn't invite me.
Hmm.
Well, even if you had invited me, there's no way I could have attended, so don't worry about it too much.
Oh, we could have set up, you know, a video link or something.
Not the same. Yeah, maybe. Anyhow, something to look forward to in the years coming up.
Right.
So,
and you wouldn't have eaten my cooking, which, if I say so myself, was darned good.
Well, that's what I hear from various people who are... Facebooking about it.
Facebooking about the cooking.
Yeah, but I know it's just sort of like, you know, yes, but that's not my radio life. It's not my, or even my, you know, producing life. This is my, that's my private life.
There's no privacy on Facebook.
Yeah, but isn't that a fact? Mm. But
have you seen the recent British series Black Mirror?
No, I have not.
It's a TV series, 3 episodes so far. I don't think there's any more for this year. It's somewhat disturbing, but has something to do with stuff people may or may not put on Facebook about their personal lives and how it may get out of hand and things like that if you get around to it. Not sure if it's genre as such. Well, at least not the first episode anyway. It's an anthology series. It's not connected throughout. So it's called Black Mirror, and I've enjoyed it, even though it's somewhat nasty at times. But
is it the Beeb?
I think it's E4.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyhow. Well, have a great morning.
You too, and happy solstice, even though it's the day after where you are.
Yeah. Good to hear from you.
Well, yeah. The exact moment was during Robert Knight's show earlier this evening.
That's right.
As he said, so that I hope you managed to listen to his show, because he did great stuff. It's the first time I actually heard it.
Well, I was here with Stephen and Gemma, but at one point he mentioned the name Mark Chartrand, whose radio show I produced here at WBAI many years ago. He was the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the time, so my ears just perked up and go, whoa, 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 what? And then he started playing David Bowie and was all over.
And Elton John, and he was a nice, he had a nice segue to Hour of the Wolf, I think.
Which is actually, when I was placed in this time slot, a lot of what I think the program director was thinking of, because Robert, you know, doesn't always do Occupy Wall Street shows. He does other radio as well.
As I said, it was the first time I've listened to the entire, to Earthwatch in its entirety, and I've enjoyed it a little too much. I'm worried about sleeping nights from now on, Thursday.
There
morning,
you go.
Early
Thursday.
So, I'll have to think of something.
Well, there's always the archive.
Well, yeah, the archive.
But then you can't call in.
Mm.
Sure. Well, have a great morning, all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for a great show.
Okay, thanks a lot. Good morning. And hi there, you're on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning, Robert.
Okay, as far as that goes, Legolas, well, he is the son of Thranduil, the Mirkwood King, so you could make a bit of a connection, but what does Elros have to do with The Hobbit? I mean, now we're going to... apparently, from what a friend of mine just recently told me, there's going to be a big backstory. I mean, to the beginning of Numenor?
Well, there was... apparently, at one time when they had Del Toro directing the film, which I thought was a terrible idea... I'm the only person in the world who did not love Pan's Labyrinth. Don't eat the food. They were going to put this whole other subtextual story in there just to drag out The Hobbit into two movies rather than take the story and simply do it, you know, lengthily as it needs to be told.
Should be very, very interesting, but I want to get to Gemma. Gemma, did you know that Charles de Lint has actually used your name in some of his Newford stories?
No.
Yes, Gemma Pooks is a musician.
Wow.
And she belongs to a Celtic rock band. She also has fairy powers and magical powers, and her, when you turn her jacket around, as she, you know, you see guys on motorcycles who then turn into fairy steeds, but that's Newford. I want to get to Steve for a second. You mentioned the name Zeke. Well, I did some checking with a friend on Answers.com.
Mm-hmm.
There is no town, unless it's hidden that nobody knows, but according to Answers.com, there is no town that's mentioned. All we know is that Dorothy was raised on a farm in the center of the Great Plains of Kansas. But when you said the name Zeke,
mm-hmm.
the first thing that came to mind was the name that the American pilots in the Solomon Islands used for Japanese Zeros, the Mitsubishi A6M.
Oh.
Every time Robert Conrad would say in Baba Black Sheep, hey, you guys are the 214 Squadron, we're not playing tag with the Zeeks. That was apparently the name that was given to them in China by the Flying Tigers.
Hmm.
Now, I want to get to Gemma's book.
No, I was thinking more of the Flying Monkeys.
Tigers. Yes, that's another story. Gemma, are you a specialist in the post-Civil War West?
I wouldn't call myself a specialist. I did some research.
Oh, well,
she dwells there.
I'll talk to you about
though.
That sometime. Your two books. Have you seen the new series Hell on Wheels?
I have seen some episodes.
What do you think of,
it? I'm mainly watching it for one person.
Who is that?
That would be the Swede.
Oh, I love the Swede. Yeah. He is even nastier than the Miles O'Brien character.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the Thomas Durant, I mean, when the foreman said to him, should we make the road straight? And he says, straight? Are you out of your mind? They're paying us $16,000 a mile, which is exactly what the government was paying. It's a great series so far.
Yeah.
'Cause I taught frontier history for 40 years, and I have to tell you, I have discovered at least 62 Western frontier tropes.
Yeah.
The only one we don't have. No, the only one we don't have is
You've
gay.
You've counted.
No. I found them. The only one we don't seem to have is gay sex.
Not so far.
Do you think that'll show up?
It's possible.
I mean, what was that movie about the sheep?
Yeah.
Cold Mountain? No, that wasn't Cold
Mountain. Brokeback Mountain.
Brokeback Mountain, yes.
Yeah. Cold
Mountain was Jude Law.
The attraction for me with the Swede is that he's played by Christopher Heyerdahl, who's an amazing...
But he is nasty.
Yeah.
He is just nasty. Somebody told me that he looks like Javert, or he could be Javert.
That's true.
If you were going to make a version of the whatever. Very quick question on your books. They are set in the post-Civil War West?
Yes, they are.
Is the series Hexslinger named for Jonah Hex by any chance?
No, it's called the Hexslinger series because there are people who use black magic who are known as hexes.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. By the way, why can't you have black magic and Aztec gods in the American frontier?
Well, exactly. It's a weird Western. You can have anything you want.
By the way, what is your website? I'd love to get in touch with you about the series in terms of reviewing it for several frontier publications.
Okay, probably the easiest way to get in touch with me would be through my live journal, where I am handful_of_dust.
Handful_of_dust.
The thing that I hate about LJ, live journal, is that you cannot penetrate people's handles.
Yeah.
Handful_of_dust. Now, will that lead me to a contact with you?
Yep. Yeah, you'll be able to leave a comment on whatever post I do next.
Handful.
Handful_of_dust.
Of dust. By the way,
live journal.
Does your third book have a title yet?
Yes, it's called A Tree of Bones.
Oh, I love this. Oh, the West Lot Rides Again. Listen, good luck.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And, well, we have... unbelievably, 1 minute left.
Ah.
Really?
Yeah. We have outro music to play, and I have an annual song. Usually at this point I play Steel Eyes Span.
Cool.
But it's the main music of this program is Steel Eyes Span. It's what I do.
Well, I love Steel Eyes Span, so
no, we're not doing that this year.
Dun, dun, dun.
Because it's solstice. So instead we have he who produced two Steel Eyes Span albums, Ian Anderson.
Hmm.
Ring out solstice bells, what do you play on the solstice? You know, Sales of Silver, listen to any other show, and possibly for my New Year's show, what I used to do on Hour of the Wolf when it was broadcast during the Hour of the Wolf is all, and you know, 2 hours of nothing but Steel Eye. And last year, I actually had Matty Pryor on the show. So
wow!
But, nice. Then, but then it turned out it was just when Tim Hart died.
Oh,
no! So
yeah,
it, that cast a pall
somewhat
on the thing. I had recorded I had actually recorded the interview with her, intended for a New Year's show. But and he died almost exactly a year ago today.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, what can one say about that? Other than, again, thank you both Steve Berenger and Gemma Files for being here. This is an unexpected show. We put it together at about 07 o'clock.
Basically, yeah.
And that's PM. And this is all prelude because you're going to come back from Toronto.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And when your third book is out.
Yep.
But before then, maybe we just have to, I'll have to talk to Genevieve and see if she's not still annoyed at me for stepping on all her lines when Geek Wisdom came out, which she and Nora, my guest last week, N.K. Jemisin.
Yeah. Amazing writer. Nora. Amazing writer.
And an amazing person she is in general.
Yeah.
But at any rate, we have to do like a serious critic music, a critic show with you and Genevieve.
Okay.
So,
I've enjoyed this very much. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Thank you for being here. Stay tuned for, what do you follow this with? Of course, Burn Baby Burn Clappers. Lester! So, woo! We go out with Jethro Tull, Ian Anderson, and next week we're back to Steel Eye Span. Good morning and happy solstice. Oh yeah, it's the remix.
Bring out these bells. Ring out, ring solstice. Silver planets run, seven maids move in seven time. Sing the sound of bells, call out the chime.
Bring out these bells, ring out, ring solstice bells.
Red 3 o'clock on the dot. WBAI 99 Syncalist Alive. This is Burn, Baby Burn Clappers. Burning the American flag to ashes until Al Jazeera kicks in.
Red, white, the blue, I'm not Captain America. Too black, too strong. Causing mass hysteria. Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself. Torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold. The bold lose control. So they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk. Cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people all around the pig work. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my right in this right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too.
Syncalist Alive welcomes back, Lori Berrison to New York City with her family right here. The show is dedicated to her and her little son and to Ralph McDonald. Burn, baby, burn. We say OWS overthrow Wall Street.
Taking action on the system, thinking they slick, contradicting their own, taking me for a fool. They sent my man Joey to jail and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game, well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you, I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on, just a mother.
Burn. Listen to Live 99 Cinco, the kind of music that's banned on Black Radio in Imperialist America right here at 99 Cinco. We play it. They refuse to play it. We play it. Reggae shows refuse to play it. We play it. That's why the show is called Burn Baby Burn. Because we play more weed tune, more sensimilla tune than any of these clowns on radio, y'all.
So let me tell you, say we want lamb's bread, me ratcha man. But I know a little dread by the name of Fred. Used to make him living by selling lamb's bread. But now him really and truly not selling it no more. Babylon a lock him in a jailhouse door. Say fi Lego not he dread. So let me tell you, make him selling lamb's bread. Come there, say you fi Lego not he dread. And let me tell you, make him selling lamb's bread. So me go to Africa and me smoke it in a chalwa. Go to Africa and smoke it in a chalwa. Me go to London fi go check me Cali man. Step a London fi go check a Cali man.
Dedicating this to my brethren who sent me a beautiful letter from Sing Sing prison. Say listen, me a listen you behind bars.
Say
yeah.
All over. We just a eat it in a chalwa. Come watch a man. Come me say old Wada Wallace. Show where your malice make we lick up the chalice in a Buckingham Palace. Chalice to chalice and you feel alright. Chalice to chalice, you know first or fight. Make we eat up lamb bread. So let me tell you about the lamb's bread, callie. And until you say it ain't no folly. So when you eat it, man, you feel so jolly. Cut it. Say that over the hills and down in the valley. I'm a virgin, just a eat up the lamb's bread, Cali. Just let me tell you, say no chance for no folly. I said I know a little dread by the name of Fred. Used to make him living by selling lamb's bread. But now me really and truly not selling it no more. Babylon a lock him in a jail all
stones. Lick it up from the top.
That's when you bad head or you're not a dread. Lick just go make we eat up lamb's bread. Eat up lamb's bread, you must go ahead. Well, tread, y'all. Say that we want lamb's bread. So let me tell you, say we want lamb's bread.
Wicked song, wicked song. New York, New York.
But I know a little dread.
So wicked, we had to name it twice, y'all.
Used to make him live in
my hogs, eat pigs.
But now we
my
really
pigs
actually
eat
not
donuts.
No more.
Burn, baby, burn, y'all.
Lock him in a jailhouse door. Say fi Lego not he dread. John, let me tell you, make him selling lamb's bread. Come there, say you feel Lego not he dread. And let me tell you, make him selling lamb's bread. I saw me go to Africa and me smoke it in a chalwa. Go to Africa and smoke it in a chalwa. Me go to London, fi go check me Cali man. Step a London, fi go check a Cali man. All over, we just a eat it in a chalwa.
Yes, I.
Say all over.
Uh-huh.
We just a eat it in a chalwa. Come watch a man.
Uh-huh.
Come me say old Wada Wallace. Hey. Show where your malice. Hey. Make we lick up the chalice in a bucket.
Yo, listen me.
Chalice
in Imperialist America, they treat weed like
chalice to chalice,
like democracy.
Make we eat up lamb bread.
Check Robert Knight if you think I'm right.
Bread,
99 single, list alive right here. Burn, baby, burn, y'all.
Falling.
To my brethren in
so
Sing Sing, this is for you.
So
my hogs eat pigs and pigs eat donuts, y'all.
And down in the valley, me and my brethren just a eat up the lamb's bread, Cali. So let me tell you, say no chance for no folly. I said I know a little dread by the name of Fred. Used to make him living by selling lamb's bread. But now we really and truly not selling it no more. Babylon a lock him in a jailhouse door. Say fi Lego not he dread. So let me tell you, make him selling lamb's bread. When I was a youth, I used to smoke lamb's bread in a front door. Another time in a car trash. Couldn't cash. But now that I'm a man, I have to smoke lamb's bread in a chalwa. Another time in a Rizla. So let me tell you, say me smoke it in Africa. So let me tell you, say me smoke it in Canada. So let me tell you, say me smoke it in London. Smoke it all over, I tell you. Chalice to chalice and you feel alright. Chalice to chalice and no fuss, no fight.
Chichi chichi chi bam bam climb on a fence. Asking a mother for $1.05. Fi go buy some ice shins. I tell you fi go buy some ice shins. Say one stick of weed for a 50 cents. Quite a bone of ice shins for $1.05. Let me smoke lamb's bread. Chon let me tell you, say the weather bad head. And you are not a dread. Smoke lamb's bread and make me forward ahead. Yeah, you know. Say me went up a constant spring. Fiwa, fi go check out me African thing. And where she bring? Lamb's bread and skin. Cause lamb's bread it keep me rocking and sing. Say that you want lamb's bread. And so me say and then you forward ahead.
Yeah, list alive, 99 Sinker right here, it's a Burn Baby Burn style, clappers, dun-dun, got to be a Thursday, because your weekend starts now, y'all. Yes, I am, when I spoke not medical, strictly hydroponic, sensomania, lamb's bread, y'all. Hey.